The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. Now, these are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. To set the stage for today's Armchair Traveler, I want to tell you about an experience my wife and I had while visiting the Big Island of Hawaii in early 2017. It was an overcast day, and we'd already spent several hours exploring the nearby Kilauea volcano. Now, this is the one you may remember that erupted back in 2018, about a year after our visit. This allowed lava to flow throughout the region for several days, as you may have heard. The day we were there, we could see from the edge of the crater gases ascending from lava gently rumbling in the heart of the crater. And after visiting the monitoring station just a few hundred yards away, where scientists kept watch on the volcanic activity, we departed aboard our minivan and then drove several miles to a small cottage-style home in a rural area on the Big Island of Hawaii. Now, we parked at the side of the house, and our guide, a trained naturalist, led us to a grove of trees where we began to descend down a path into what appeared to be the entrance of a cave. Now, before entering, he cautioned our group, and there was about 10 of us, I think, in that day. We had to stay close, follow his instructions. Well, we enter the cave. He told us that we're going inside a lava tube. Now, this tube was created by flowing lava from a volcanic eruption many, many years earlier. After traversing a narrow set of steps, we eventually came to a slightly wider area lit by artificial light, showing stalactites, which gave off colorful hues like that of a glowing oven. Our guide explained that he was about to turn off the lights. So, stay close and don't move. Suddenly, dark. I mean, darker than anything I had ever experienced in my life. The blackness so thick I could not see anyone around me. Nor could I see my hand when I attempted to bring it close to my face. After a few minutes, the guide announced he would restore the lights, and it took us a moment to adjust our eyes after experiencing absolute darkness. It was definitely an unforgettable experience. We also learned during our trip that the hardened lava created from the hot liquid lava flow was ground up and used to make roads throughout Hawaii. The lava also helped the island to grow as it continues to flow toward the surrounding ocean, increasing the coastline little by little after each eruption. Now, this experience in Hawaii came to mind when I read our first article, getting ready for today's program. It's called Into the Fire, and it's from the June 2024 issue of National Geographic. Writer Emma Lira tells us about a volcano in the Canary Islands that pushed rivers of molten lava through the earth, carving out tunnels, just like I described, that stretch for miles. Today's scientists and explorers trek through these lava or fire tubes. They continue to cool underground, and they're looking for insights into life on our planet, as well as perhaps others. So now let us enjoy this article, Into the Fire, and let's find out what they're going to reveal. We could be on another planet. A craggy, hostile surface stretches as far as the eye can see, framed by slopes of black ash. These are the new lava flows on La Palma in the volcanic Canarian Archipelago off the coast of Morocco. They appeared in the fall of 2021 when, for 3 months, more than 50 billion gallons of molten rock erupted from the island's Ajagate volcano. Now, transit through most of the lava field is still reserved for scientists and environmental officials. I'm accompanying Octavio Fernandez Lorenzo, Vice President of the Canary Islands Speleology Federation. Alongside researchers from the Geological and Mining Institute of Spain, IGME, Fernandez is responsible for exploring and surveying the tunnels that lava left in its wake. Known in most scientific literature as byproducts or lava tubes, they have a more poetic name here on La Palma, Caños de Fuego, translated as fire pipes. Now, Fernandez hands me a helmet, checks our water supply, and heads toward a white fence where a sign warns us not to cross. The road that brought us to this place cuts off abruptly and disappears under the blanket of lava. It feels as if we're abandoning civilization. Fire pipes can be found almost anywhere on the planet where there is or has been volcanic activity. In contrast to typical caves formed over millions of years, these cavities are made in a geological instant, but not all volcanoes create lava tubes. The eruption must be long enough to expel adequate lava. That lava must be hot enough and composed of the right materials to remain fluid, and it has to descend a slope at the right speed. At around 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, Pahoehoe, smooth in Hawaiian, lava can flow. It's the same word used to define a calm sea, says Fernandez. I can picture it quite vividly. A sea of incandescent, syrupy lava advances, spilling downhill. The outer layer cools on contact with the air and begins to solidify, forming the crust that will become the roof of the tube. The lava continues to stream, unimpeded for miles, under the thermally insulated cover. When the eruption dies down and the channels drain, the result is a subterranean labyrinth of hollow tunnels separated from the surface only by the volcano's skin. Leaning on a long white stick, which helps him move nimbly over hardened lava, Fernandez looks a bit like a wizard from the Lord of the Rings. He studies our strides as if he were the guardian of this newborn space. Step where I step, he warns. This whole environment is extremely fragile. It seems paradoxical that this imposing landscape, once capable of swallowing houses and banana plantations, could now be vulnerable. Our hike to the tubes takes an hour along a slope of sharp, living rock. This is aia lava, a Hawaiian term for rough and stony. That, many believe, sounds like what someone walking barefoot on the jagged surface might say. Phrases from Hawaii's active and intensely studied hotspots have been adapted by volcanology. Other languages have their own words that evoke images. For example, in Spanish, this barren terrain is called Malpais, or Bad Island. We walk slowly. Fernandez picks up a tiny, immaculately white pyroclastic rock and hands it to me. It's what researchers called restingalite, after the eruption on the La Restinga region of the neighboring island of El Hierro in 2011, when hundreds of pieces of whitish rock were found floating on the ocean, giving rise to a scientific debate that, unlike the eruption, has yet to die down. One hypothesis for their origin, they're bits of the foundation of which La Palma grew, ancient ocean sediments from that 2-million-year-old seabed. Looking at the small fragment brings about an inexplicable feeling of vertigo. David Sanzvangas, a geological engineer specializing in the study of extreme events and heritage at the IGME, puts it this way: it's like looking out at a window into our past. Barely a month into the eruption on La Palma, scientists detected lava tubes. They're not obvious to the naked eye. Drone imagery captured during the eruption helped predict their possible routes. One tube was discovered in June 2022, 6 months after the eruption ceased, as workers were starting to build a new road over the hardened flow. When they came across a cave-like space, they had to pause. And that was when Sanz, who relocated from Madrid to the Canary Islands to study the eruption's aftermath, joined the team and began exploring the newborn fire pipes of La Palma. Based on field data obtained in the Hawaiian archipelago, the place with the largest volcanic cavities in the world, we assumed exploration of the tubes would begin in about 2 years after the eruption, he says, but here we saw that with difficulty it was accessible. Drones are crucial to field work. The first step was to begin a series of thermal flights that would monitor the open holes in the lava field, he says, and to start exploring them little by little. The so-called red tube is a product of the lava rivers 3 years ago flowed down into the small town of Todoke. Today, a pair of entrances about 200 feet apart allow air to circulate. Instead of hot air coming out, the mouth sucks in fresh air from the outside, Fernandez says. This is the best laboratory we have right now to learn how the lava flows cool. We turn our headlamps on, crawl in, and confront the surprising reddish color of the walls. On the ceiling, we see dark brown lava stalactites hanging like droplets that solidified before they could fall and now suspended forever. They look like melted chocolate. Inside the tube, the air is cooler than the walls, anywhere from 120 to 210 degrees, according to a probe. We balance against these walls with our gloved hands as we move forward, step by step. The humidity and the mix of temperatures give the cave the pleasant sensation of a Turkish bath. With a thermal drone, Fernandez takes temperature readings. About 100 yards in from the mouth, he tells us to stop. The heat is increasing significantly, and not far ahead, the tube narrows and exhales as temperatures of more than 480 degrees. In the video feed, the air shudders like a mirage. This mouth is just one of more than 100 identified so far, mostly by drone flights overhead, though some remain too camouflaged to spot from the air. Just a tiny number have been explored. Openings are viable only if the temperature allows. In lava flows up to 65 feet thick, cooling can go on for 2.5 years. At 150 or 200 feet thick, it might be 20 years. It's too soon to predict how far these tunnels reach. Scientists believe that the network may be composed of up to 3 overlapping levels. Sands thinks it could be the most extensive tube system in Europe. That title is currently held by the Viento Sobrado cave system beneath Mount Tede on the neighboring island of Tenerife. With more than 11 miles of tunnels, it was considered the largest volcanic tube in the world for a brief moment until in 1995 a man named Harry Schick found a cave entrance in his yard on the island of Hawaii. It would turn out to be the access point to more than 40 miles of tubes branching out from the Kilauea volcano. And that was the area that I described as we began this program today. While there is much to learn from these tunnels, and perhaps not just about our world, Anna Z. Miller, a geomicrobiologist from Seville's Institute of Natural Resources and Agrobiology, is the daughter of artists. The course of her life changed when her parents gave her a microscope at the age of 9. Since then, she has focused her lens on those small life forms that go unnoticed by the human eye. Her first discoveries were made in La Palma's fire pipes, studying their peculiar gelatinous speleothems, or mineral deposit formations. Miller's research on extremophile species, especially bacteria capable of obtaining the energy to develop from inorganic matter, led the European Space Agency to recruit her for its Pangaea X project. The mission was to train astronauts and the collection and analysis of microbial samples on the nearby island of Lanzarote inside a lava tube, whose conditions appear comparable to lava tubes on the Moon and Mars. Since 2009, when a Japanese space probe discovered the Marias Hill skylight, possible entrance to one of the moon's volcanic sites. And let's see here. This is a tube on the moon. The scientific community has been studying the similarities between terrestrial volcanic tubes and their planetary counterparts. Now, for Miller, the question is no longer if we will find life on other planets, but when. Martian and lunar caves differ greatly from ours in terms of environmental conditions and gravity, which affect their size and stability. However, their formation and surroundings have more in common with terrestrial ones than one might think, says Francesco Sualo, a European Space Agency scientist and National Geographic explorer. If there is or has been life in these otherworldly lava tubes, it could be microbial as it is in the fire pipes of La Palma. The recent eruption in La Palma gives us a unique opportunity to learn about the pioneering microbiota in these formed lava tubes, says Miller. The island's volcanic tubes are already inhabited. Miller's team has identified known bacteria as well as other life belonging to phyla or Pseudomonadota and Bacteriadota, which could ultimately be identified as a new species. La Palma's volcanic route, an old hiking trail that reveals the island's distinctive landscape, is open again. From there, a path still carpeted with ashes leads to another partially explored tube known by scientists as Hornito Bonito, Pretty Little Oven. We come across a group of tourists who have hiked to see the main cone of the volcano, recently named Ajagate, Cracked Mountain in the island's native language. The rest of the area requires accreditation and even a gas meter en masse because conditions can vary from one moment to the next. The ash field is deserted, as unspoiled as the eruption left it, and covered with small craters. Each one houses a rounded stone like an oyster with a pearl. The stones are viscous or viscous fragments spat out by the volcano, smoothed by friction with the air. Volcanic comb, says Fernandez. He takes one in his hands, shows me, and then puts it back in place. They're part of this virgin landscape, or at least until someone decides to start taking them as souvenirs. Now, the ideal would be to create a network of marked and monitored trails so that everyone could enjoy this new geological richness, without damaging it and without encountering any risk, Fernandez says. Now, he pays close attention to our steps and turns at any suspicious creak. The layer of hardened lava is a thin biscuit, not even 2 inches thick. Underneath, there may be a bubble, a crack, where the temperature can exceed 900 degrees. The Hornito Bonito rises up like an artisanal oven or a sandcastle. The Hornitos are like many volcanoes, explains Fernandez. This one was formed in just 3 days. It appeared right above the north face of the volcano's main cone when a jet of lava shot 100 feet in the air. As it lost strength, gases began to bubble up, expelling spatters that piled up until they formed a truncated conical tower. A nearby entrance is a huge hole that descends into the tube, giving an idea of the lava waterfall that must have circulated. The edges solidify around it. A light white powder seems to settle on everything, condensing into tiny white stalactites as thin as needles. The researchers are still studying their composition. They are ephemeral minerals doomed to transform and disappear with every drop of water. Maybe by the time we know what they are, they won't exist anymore. The earth here gives you a sense of reverence toward places touched by disasters. I turn my headlamp off to feel the darkness. The silence and the solitude are breathtaking. Eventually, we cross the lava field back to our cars. It's raining, and the puddling water kicks up clouds and steam. Our clothes are soaked, but I don't feel cold. Heat is emanating from the living stock. Wow. Very good description there. Well, next we're going to visit with an explorer featured in Aaron Blakemore's article, Back to Life. This was published in the May 2024 issue of National Geographic. Now, as Blakemore explains, more than 500 years after her death in the Andes and nearly 3 decades after her discovery, we're finally able to put a face on the Ice Maiden of Ambato. So let's learn more. Sometime in the mid to late 1400s, a 15-year-old girl was escorted up an Andean peak and sacrificed to Inca gods. Buried on the mountain with a variety of offerings, the young woman's body naturally mummified over time, with her hair, her fingernails, and the colorful robes she wore on her last day intact. But at some point across the centuries, her face became exposed to the elements, her features slowly vanishing over seasons of sunlight and snowfall. Now that long-lost face has been recovered, thanks to painstaking archaeological analysis and forensic reconstruction. A striking 3D bust of the young woman, known today as the Ice Maiden of Ambato, is the centerpiece of a new exhibit in Peru, and part of an ongoing effort to understand the practice of human sacrifice in the Andes a half a millennia ago. Sacrificial offerings. When National Geographic explorer Johann Reinhardt encountered the mummy, also known as Juanita, atop a 20,700-foot Mount Ambato during the 1995 expedition, he knew almost immediately that he had found something spectacular. At first it looked like one bundle of textiles, Reinhardt recalls, but then he saw the wizened face amid the folds of fabric. Here was a young victim of the mysterious Inca ritual known as Capacocha. The practice sacrificed mostly children and young women who were offered to the gods not only in response to natural disasters or simply to please them, but also to consolidate state power in far-flung provinces of the Inca Empire. Capacocha played an important part in sustaining the empire It involved feast and grand processions to accompany the children who appear to have been chosen for their beauty and physical perfection. Being selected for sacrifice, researchers believe, would have been considered a deep honor by the child's family and community. Most of the information that is known about Capacocha, however, is secondhand. Dagmara Socha, an archaeologist with the Center for Andean Studies at the University of Warsaw, studies the ritual and commissioned the facial reconstruction of the ice maiden in Vampato. No European colonist ever saw the ceremony, she explains. Despite gaps in the historical record, the high-altitude archaeological discoveries of more than a dozen Inca children on Ampato and other Andean mountains provide critical evidence for what happened during these rituals. The means of sacrifice varied, perhaps because of customs related to specific gods. Some children were buried alive or strangled. Others had their hearts removed. The Ice Maiden's life ended with a single blunt force blow to the back of her skull. Oscar Nielsen knows the girl's skull well. He spent months with a replica of it in his Stockholm studio, eventually fashioning a sculpture of that glimpsed from afar almost seems alive. It was a two-step process, says the Swedish archaeologist and sculptor. First, Nielsen immersed himself in the world of his subject with an archaeologist's eye for detail, digesting as much data as possible to understand what she might have looked like. Even without her mummified face, he could extrapolate the likely depth of the facial tissues that once draped those bones, using everything from CT scans to information about diet and disease to make educated guesses about her faces. Then came the handiwork. Nielsen's printed a 3D replica of the Ice Maiden's skull, plugging wooden pegs onto its surface to guide the depth and placement of each handcrafted plasticine clay muscle. Eyes, masseters, a nose, the delicate rope-like tissues that constitute a human face, each was added in turn. After using a mold to make a silicon bust, he added hundreds of individual hairs and pores in shades of brown and pink. It took 10 weeks. The resulting sculpture, wrapped in robes woven by women from Peru's Centro de Textiles Tradicionales El Cusco, is the main attraction of Capacocha, following the Inca gods, which opens in November 2023 in Museo Santiago Andinos Arequipa. Now, the Ice Maiden reconstruction is displayed alongside her mummified remains and accompanied by the stories of 18 additional children selected for a Capacocha atop Ampito and other Andean mountains. Now, their ages range from 8 to about 16, and the mummies and skeletal remains of several are featured as 3D models in the exhibition, which also showcases holographs of some of the sacred items buried alongside them. These natural mummies offer scientists intriguing clues about their last days. When Socha and the colleagues conducted toxicological and forensic analyses of the remains of a toddler and 4 6- to 7-year-old victims of Capacocha, the researchers found that they were well-nourished in the months before their sacrifice. They were also fed coca leaves, and this is an ayahuasca vine, and alcohol in the weeks before their deaths, perhaps not so much to intoxicate them as to keep them sedated and anxiety-free while the timeline hurtled toward their sacrifice. We were really surprised, says the toxicology results, Sosa says. It wasn't only a brutal sacrifice. The Inca also wanted the children to be in a good mood. It was important to them that they go happily to the gods. High-altitude psychotropic substances, the dramatic view, the knowledge of the afterlife was near, all must have made for an astonishing ceremony, says Reinhardt. The whole phenomenon must have been overpowering. During the last phase of Nielsen's reconstruction, he spent hours contemplating and attempting to capture the young girl's presence half a millennium after her death. The result is both unsettlingly realistic and jarringly personal. She was an individual, the forensic reconstructionist says. She must have understood her life would end on the mountaintop in a couple of weeks. We can only hope that she believed in the afterworld herself. For Reinhardt, the Ice Maiden's story came full circle when he finally saw the face of the girl he carried down the mountain on the back decades ago. It brings her back to life, he says. The reconstruction focuses as much on her culture and daily life as on her violent death. But Nielsen never forgot the way the Ice Maiden died, even as he revived her through the reconstruction. More than anything, he says, he wanted to convey a sense of being frozen. Not to her icy, mummified feature, but also to a girl teetering on the edge of eternity, though still very much alive. She knew she was supposed to smile, to express pride, he says, proud to be chosen, but still very, very afraid. Quite a story there, right? Well, we're going to wrap up today's journey by reading excerpts from Her Secret Guardians, an article by Leslie Patrick, appearing in the March 2024 issue of National Geographic. When Anne Boleyn was executed in 1536, her prized Book of Hours went missing for centuries. Now, Patrick writes, we know who helped keep that book safe. Anne Boleyn, King Henry VIII's second queen, is often portrayed as a seductress and ultimately the woman responsible for changing the face of religion in England. Boleyn is now recognized as a fiercely intelligent and pious figure dedicated to education and religious reform. But after her arrest and execution on questionable charges of adultery and incest in May 1536, Henry VIII was determined to erase her. Her royal emblems were removed from palace walls, her sparkling jewels tucked away in dark coffers, and her precious books disappeared from the annals of time. But one of Boleyn's possessions, her Book of Hours, reappeared. The stunning prayer book, printed around 1527 with devotional text designed to be read throughout the day, features hand-painted woodcuts as well as a rare example of the Queen's own writing. In the margins of one of the beautifully decorated pages, she penned a rhyming couplet followed by her signature. Remember me when you do pray, that hope doth lead from day to day. Anne Boleyn. The book vanished after Boleyn's execution, then resurfaced in the early 20th century, when American millionaire William Waldorf Astor bought Hever Castle, Boleyn's childhood home in the English countryside. The journey of the disgraced queen's devotional book remained a mystery, however, until new research revealed previously unknown signatures on its pages, which helped trace part of its path through history. The book's whereabouts in the 360-year-old odd years between Boleyn's death and its reemergence remained puzzling until 2020. That's when Kate McCaffrey, then a graduate student from the University of Kent, working on her master's thesis about the Queen's Book of Hours, found something unexpected in the margins. I noticed what appeared to be smudges to the naked eye, recalls Caffrey, an assistant curator at Hever Castle since 2021. Intrigued, she borrowed an industrial-strength ultraviolet light set it up in the castle's darkest room. This type of light's often used to examine historical documents because ink absorbs the ultraviolet wavelength, causing it to appear darker against the page when exposed. The words just came through. It was incredible to see them underneath the light. They were completely illuminated, and the curator recalls, and with that, they were able to trace back the writers and those who kept that book protected until it was rediscovered. Quite a story there, huh, about Anne Boleyn. And my friends, that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. The website again, ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.